In the Old Testament, prophecies about the life and death and the mission of Jesus Christ were so clearly written and documented that Jesus would say to the Jews of his day that he was revealed just as clearly in the Old Testament, which was the only scriptures at the time, as when he was walking with them in person. Just as clearly. And they had, the Jews, had been the keepers of the oracles of God. They had this tremendous advantage that God gave them his truths through the many prophets, and that they had 1,500 years of collecting prophecies about the coming Messiah. Here's a reference scripture I won't turn to, but in John 5, verse 37, John 5, verse 37, Jesus is in a situation speaking to the teachers, the lawyers, and the priests. They were trying to trap him in his words. In verse 37, he said, "And the Father himself, who has sent me, has testified of me. You have neither seen him nor heard his voice at any time, nor seen his form. But you do not have his word abiding in you, because whom he sent, him you do not believe." Verse 39 says, "You search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life. And these are they," meaning these scriptures, "are they which testify of me. But you're not willing to come to me that you may have life." So the Jews were very diligent about searching out the scriptures. And when you put together Daniel and Jeremiah and Isaiah, and you start to put the different things together that were prophesied, they knew the time was ripe for the Messiah to come, that God was bringing them a deliverer, and he was bringing them a savior, although their concept of him was very distorted. They thought that he was going to come as a conqueror and overturn the Roman occupation and bring Israel back to its former glory, as in the days of Solomon. But it wasn't going to be at that time. It wasn't going to be at that time. So when Jesus describes this, that he's speaking with a religious leadership whose religion had become so empty, outward forms clouded their hearts, and their pride and jealousy of Jesus Christ's success and the huge crowds that were following him was blinding their eyes. They ended up misunderstanding, again, who he was and what his mission was all about. And so Jesus says in verse 31, again, still in reference, "If I bear witness of myself," he says, "my witness is not true." In other words, if I testify about myself, my testimony is not valid, it says in the NIV. Why? Words are cheap. Anyone can tout anything about himself. And until someone else validates and confirms about what somebody is saying about himself, it's not valid. It just doesn't have the same credibility. This is what he's telling them. He didn't have to testify of himself. He had so many other witnesses. Let me just briefly mention four of them. Four different sources that Jesus Christ had to validate who he was and what his mission was, that he didn't have to tell people outright what it was. Moses and numerous other prophets testified in advance of him, from Adam and Enoch forward. John the Baptist, even before Jesus Christ came and approached him one day in the Jordan River and said, you're going to baptize me. And he says, "I'm not even worthy to untie your sandals. And you want me to baptize you?" But he had been told ahead of time through the Holy Spirit that he was going to be doing that. He testified of the Messiah. The Father testified of the Son. You remember at this baptism, a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, in whom I'm well pleased." You also recall at the Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John, a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, listen to him, hear his words." Christ's miracles, there's another powerful testimony. He didn't even have to talk. He healed the blind, the lame, the sick, the demon-possessed. powerful testimony. He raised the dead. He even had the power on earth to forgive people's sins. These were divine attributes. Nobody else, even another miracle worker, could not forgive sins on earth like Jesus Christ could. So many witnesses, and there's a reason for bringing this up by way of introduction. And when he says in John 5, verse 46, "For if you believed Moses, you would have believed me. For Moses wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how are you going to believe my words?" So again, Jesus Christ didn't depend on his own testimony to convince anybody. This leads to my topic today. I'd like to take you on a walk figuratively today, a walk with me in this message, to get a glimpse of what it might have been like for the disciples to have their eyes opened to the meaning of the scriptures that were secluded and were hidden from them prior to this moment at the start of the New Testament church. Let's go on a short walk as two disciples did on the road to Emmaus. And that's the title today, A Walk to Emmaus. And I'll spell Emmaus for you. A Walk to Emmaus, E-M-M-A-U-S. A Walk to Emmaus. There's a subtitle as well. Subtitle we'll bring up again later. It's The Gospel in the Old Testament. The Gospel in the Old Testament. Let's do now turn to Luke 24, verse 13 together. Luke 24, verse 13. We'll see where this narrative begins, where two disciples are on a dusty mountainous road on a 7-mile walk from Jerusalem to a little town named Emmaus. Luke 24, verse 13. As you're turning to Luke 24, verse 13, prior to this walk, this 7-mile walk, it was only days or 3 days earlier that Jesus Christ was crucified and he was buried. It was on a Wednesday afternoon, just before sunset, that his body was placed in a tomb. It was before the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In 3 days, the weekly Sabbath during unleavened bread was drawing to a close now. Jesus Christ would fulfill the prophecy of Jonah that as Jonah was in the large fish for 3 days and three nights, the Son of Man would be in the belly of the earth 3 days and three nights. Just before the sun sets, he wakes. The stone is removed. He folds up his burial cloths neatly. He comes out. He's out of the tomb. It was the very next morning before sunrise that he was discovered when the women came to finish the preparations for his final burial. They brought the spices before the Sabbath, and they rested on the weekly Sabbath as well as the first day of unleavened bread. They came back to prepare his body for a permanent burial, and they find his body's gone, and they see the angels who tell him, "Go tell the others, he is risen." And they do, with all the excitement, they believed, and they go and tell the others. They don't get believed by the others. Peter and the others are thinking, this is nuts, this is crazy, you've got to be kidding. But Peter says, I better look into this. He runs, he races out to the tomb, and he finds the same thing. He's gone. Luke 24, verse 13. Now we're talking about later that afternoon, of that Sunday, the very next day after he comes out of the tomb. Out of the tomb, these two disciples of Jesus Christ are walking on the road. They're traveling that day, verse 13, that same day to a village called Emmaus, which was 7 miles from Jerusalem. Verse 14, and they talked together of all these things which just happened. Verse 15, so it was when they conversed and they reasoned that Jesus himself drew near and started walking alongside these two disciples. Verse 16, but their eyes were restrained so that they did not know who he was. I'll just pause for a moment with me and picture two men walking on this dusty dirt road, and Jesus Christ, the risen Savior of all humankind, comes along. They don't know who he is. He's a stranger, but he wants to start a dialogue and start finding out what they're talking about. He wants to share in the conversation. They had no clue who he was. Jesus Christ had covered their discernment, kind of blinded their eyes to his true identity. It would be very soon he would release that veil over their eyes and they would recognize him right when the time was right. We see other times in the New Testament when Jesus Christ is being assaulted by a crowd and they were starting to stone him, that he suddenly confuses people's understanding or discernment of who he is, and he's able to walk through a crowd as if he was somebody that they lose track of him. That is just a miracle that he was able to do when the time needed it, when it was important to cloak his identity. Verse 17, he says to them, "What kind of conversation is this that you have with one another as you walk and you're sad? You both look so sad." And the one whose name was Cleopas answered and said to him, "Are you the only stranger in all of Jerusalem, and you have not known the things which happened here these past 3 days?" And I'll pause with me to consider something else. This is an innocent approach. It's not deceptive. He's not trying to trick them. We already know that Jesus Christ, during his earthly ministry, is able to read people's hearts, intents of the heart. He can read people's minds. He did that multiple times when he would walk up to his own 12, inner circle of 12 disciples and says, "What are you talking about?" He already knew what they were talking about, especially if they were bickering and complaining over something or arguing about something. So he knows this already. He already knows what these two disciples are talking about. He's setting the stage, though, for something very positive with some big returns. Verse 19, he says to them, "What things?" As in, "What things are you both talking about?" They said back to him, "The things regarding Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. And how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened," meaning 3 full days had gone by. This actually was the close of the fourth day, but 3 full days had gone by since Jesus Christ came out of what was crucified and buried. Verse 22, "Yes, and certain women of our company who arrived at the tomb early astonished us. When they did not find his body, they came saying that they had also seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. And certain of those who were there with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they didn't see." So far, can we tell that these events in the last 3 days, these dizzying array of events, have just left them discouraged and confused over what it all meant? I mean, to see this mighty prophet killed by the religious leadership after he had done so many miracles for 3.5 years. And so here where Jesus Christ is aware of their feelings on this. Verse 25, then he says to them, "Oh, foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets had spoken. Ought not the Christ to have suffered these things and to have entered into his glory?" Verse 27, "And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself." Their eyes must have lit up. They must have felt a surge of excitement. We will see it will happen. This did happen this way. But for a moment, let's skip back to Luke 16 and verse 31. Luke 16, verse 31, there's a fundamental statement that also helps set the stage to where we're going with this message today on this walk to Emmaus. Luke 16, verse 31. The discussion here is the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. Jesus is talking to a group of Pharisees because in their lust for money, they were neglecting to care for the less fortunate, the poor and the needy and the widows. And so they were ignoring God's clear laws on such matters. Verse 31, and he just says in conclusion, if they do not hear or listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rise from the dead. And we know that there was going to be a sensational miracle toward the very last couple of days that Jesus Christ was alive in Bethany, and he raised Lazarus, not the one in the parable, but the real Lazarus, his friend, out of the tomb after being in there for 4 days. And so he's saying, even if someone is raised from the dead, if they don't believe Moses' word, they're not going to believe mine. They're not going to believe mine either. Again, in their zeal, they studied the scriptures, the religious leaders of the day, but they misunderstood the words of Moses, and they would now be blind to even a miracle of raising a dead person. They had been watching and waiting for a deliverer for 1,500 years. And they misunderstood the whole person and mission of Jesus Christ when he came. Again, they discredited him because of their jealousy, their envy, watching these crowds get bigger and bigger and bigger, and these wonderful miracles they could not deny him doing. And yet they wanted to kill him, and they did. They killed their own Savior. Now it is said that there are none so blind as those who refuse to see. It's a well-known saying. There are none so blind as those who refuse to see. Now God says he can and will send spiritual blindness to those who refuse to believe when the truth is offered to people. Now he does it in his own timing, in his own way. God works in various ways depending on his will, but as a rule, he can send spiritual blindness after a period of time when someone is offered the truth and they reject it. I won't turn, but John 9, verse 36 is another case here, a situation. John 9, verse 36, by way of a reference here. You remember the man who was blind from birth, and Jesus Christ healed him on the Sabbath one day. And then he went to describe this miracle to the Pharisees. And they said that this Jesus Christ, he said, well, who healed you? He was Jesus Christ. I don't know the man. But he says, well, this man's a sinner and a false teacher. They banished him from synagogue life, which was right at the heart of the community. If you were banished from the synagogue life in those New Testament times, you were an outcast of society, essentially. And when Jesus caught up with this man later, and he helped the man understand why this was so perplexing and why did they cast him out just for sharing this good news that this man healed him who had been blind from birth. Jesus Christ explains to him, verse 36, he says, for judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may be made blind. An incredible tension was going to build for the rest of this New Testament age in terms of what God was revealing and how people accept or reject truth. I'm not saying that it's black and white. God does different judgments at different times. And he shows mercy to whom he will show mercy, and he will correct those whom he will correct. But it's in God's wisdom. Now, holding our place in Luke for a moment, let's please do turn to Matthew 13, verse 10. Matthew 13, verse 10. Here is where you and I come into the equation. This was at a moment when Jesus was asked a question about his teaching method. In a nutshell, why do you speak in parables? Verse 10, the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? He answered and said to them, because it's been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. But to them it's not been given. For whoever has, to him more will be given, and he will have abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. This means that whoever treasures and develops the light and the grace, the knowledge of the truth, the opportunities that go along with it, that person is going to see a steady increase of those things. What goes around comes around. God will continue to bless that person who treasures these precious truths. On the opposite side, whoever doesn't continue to grow spiritually, when given those opportunities, they will slowly fade away. A person's spiritual life will atrophy. They will drift. The longer a person is not connected in a relationship with God or allows the cares of this world and the trials and the thistles and the thorns of this life to overtake them and not stay focused on God and his kingdom and his righteousness, there's a spiritual drift. It's just a natural course of things. There is a spiritual drift. And so he says, therefore, verse 13, I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled. And he quotes Isaiah 6, verse 10. Again, we're in Matthew 13, verse 13, but or 14, but he quotes Isaiah. Hearing you will hear and shall not understand. Seeing you will see and not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull. Their ears are hard of hearing. Their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them. God actually does this in mercy. He does this in mercy so that he might shed light at another time. As each of us understands that there are resurrections where each in his proper order will be resurrected, and that God will pour out his Holy Spirit on all flesh, starting in the beginning of the millennium, and people whose eyes have been blinded, that even heard the gospel in many cases, will have their eyes, their spiritual eyes and ears opened. Even if they might have heard it, but it didn't fall on fertile ears. But there again, God is the one who will make those judgments. Verse 16, this is where you and I have been called and blessed to be recipients and to understand and to react and respond to God's truth. Verse 16, he says to his disciples that asked the question, but blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For assuredly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see, and did not see it, and to hear what you hear, and did not hear it. Again, even prophets and righteous men of God, that God would allow them at a later date to understand the things that now were being revealed in the New Testament era, starting with those disciples that he's speaking with. It is said that only God can make blind eyes see, deaf ears hear, and hardened hearts soft, and dead taste buds to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Only God can do that. And so, brethren, we count it a blessing that we too have been called and our eyes have been opened, our ears are open to hear the truth. Tomorrow at Pentecost, our messages will share more on this miracle of God opening spiritual eyes and ears as we go into tomorrow's messages. But back to this walk to Emmaus. What might have that conversation sounded like for the next few minutes here? Let's look into some very scriptures that Jesus Christ might have spoken about while he was telling them about these things that were written for hundreds of years about himself in the scriptures. Let's please hold our place in Luke 24. If you're in Matthew probably, but we're going to come back to Luke. Let's go to Let's go to Isaiah 52. We're going to spend most of the rest of our time in Isaiah 52 with a few other scriptures in the New Testament to show the where prophecies have been fulfilled. Isaiah 52, verse 13. Isaiah 52, verse 13 contains a section known as the servant song. The servant song. Isaiah 52 and 53, it's a 15-verse section. This is the fourth group called servant song. There are three others in addition, but this is the fourth in a series. It is the most central part of the second half of the book of Isaiah. This particular 15-verse section, servant song, is quoted more frequently in the New Testament than any other Old Testament passage, and is often referred to as the Gospel of the Old Testament, or the Gospel in the Old Testament. Let's go to Isaiah 52, verse 13, and let's read together. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Did that happen in Jesus Christ's day? It's a rhetorical question. Very few people exalted Jesus Christ in his day that he walked the earth. A few people worshipped at his feet and also and declared that he was the Son of God. Very few people were revealed at it while he had 3.5 years of wonderful miracle working and teaching with such power. We know he started his life with a very humble birth. There was nothing royal or distinguishing about him. He didn't have any special physical attributes that were appealing. A few people, again, exalted him, but not very many. So when did this exaltation take place? Again, if you have a marker in Isaiah 52, we'll continually come back here, but Ephesians 1 and verse 19 gives us the answer. Ephesians 1 and verse 19. This is a prayer from Paul about the brethren. He prays for the brethren that the first fruits of many brethren, that it might be revealed to them this all exaltation of Jesus Christ. Verse 19, he prays, what is the exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe, according to the working of his mighty power, which he worked in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all principality and power and might and dominion, and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that age yet to come. And he put all things under his feet and gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. So right now, Jesus Christ is in that exalted position that was declared long ago in Isaiah. It didn't happen so much when he was walking on this earth, but as he entered the heavenly realm and sat at the right hand of the Father, he is now exalted, and he will come back in mighty glory, power, and majesty with that same exalted position that he has in heaven. And then he will dwell on the earth for 1,000 years and beyond. And it says later after that, the Father will make his home on the earth. But right now, he is in that exalted position. Let's continue. Isaiah 52, verse 14. Isaiah 52, verse 14. It says, just as many were astonished at you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Very poetic way of saying that he was abused and he was beaten to a point where it was hard to distinguish him. His face was so marred with the beating. I won't turn, but Matthew 27, verse 27, one of those passages we probably read at or before Passover. It talks about when the garrison under Governor Pilate had twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head and a reed in his right hand. They bowed the knee before him. They mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spat on him. They took a reed, struck him over the head. And when they mocked him, they took his robe off, put his own clothes back on him, led him away to be crucified. This was prophesied long before the things he was going to have to suffer for all humanity. Isaiah 52, verse 15. Now we look at a prophecy that extends far into the future. Isaiah 52, verse 15. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Sprinkle in the Bible oftentimes refers to a purification process, a cleansing ceremony to clean an unclean person, or ceremonially cleanse an unclean person. So he shall sprinkle many nations is one possible translation. The Greek word is nazo. It can also be translated, as in the Revised Standard Version, as startle. He shall startle the nations. Both can be appropriate and fit the context here. It says, so shall he sprinkle or startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him. For what had not been told them, they shall see. And what they had not heard, they shall consider. We're talking about a millennial time and the great white throne judgment, when Gentile kings around the world will learn about this profound sacrifice that they had never heard of before in many cases. And Christ is going to be honored and venerated by the kings and the royal people of the earth and by all nations at that time. Back to Isaiah 53, verse 1. Isaiah 53, verse 1. We roll over into the next chapter. Again, it's 15 verses that covers a section of these two chapters. Who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord eternal been revealed? John 12, verse 37. John quotes this passage. And that Jesus was met by a number of Greeks who came to talk to Jesus, but they didn't believe him or his mission. Just a single passage, it says in John 12, verse 12, but though he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, Lord, who has believed our report, meaning, our message, this gospel message, who has believed it? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? You see, Isaiah considers himself just one of a long line of prophets. This from Barnes Notes Commentary. And just one of a long line of prophets whose messages were rejected. And when he spoke about a coming Messiah, they didn't believe him. And then when the Messiah actually came to his own people, the same pattern ensued. The religious leadership of Jesus Christ's day, they rejected him as an imposter, as a counterfeit, as a false prophet. And yet Israel was being blessed with so many precious truths. Back to Isaiah 53, verse 2. Isaiah 53, verse 2. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Again, going back to the fact that he did not come with a carriage or a persona or even a face that was appealing like King Saul. He was head and shoulders over others. He's very handsome. King David was called very handsome and good-looking. Jesus Christ was a rather plain-looking individual. He didn't have the bearing or distinction of royalty, although he carried himself with the bearing of royalty in various difficult situations. He came to earth with such a humble beginning, and that the nation of Israel as a whole would look down upon him, because as it is human nature, we like to adore and praise things that are beautiful, and wealthy people will get all kinds of adulation. It's very common in human nature not to give that same kind of credit and appeal towards the more common things in this world. It's very typical for human beings to judge a book by its cover, so to speak. But that was all part of God's plan. All part of God's plan to see who truly would listen to the message and not be distracted by the messenger in terms of his face and his physical attributes. But who would listen to the message? This was all by God's plan. Isaiah 53, verse 3. He is despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. Again, one of the passages which we customarily read during Passover. God allowed Satan to tempt Jesus Christ often and put stumbling blocks in front of him all the way through his life and his ministry. Satan would have put every bit of ammunition, every craftiness, every ploy, everything that he could to get Jesus Christ to sin one time. Satan failed. Satan failed his mission. Satan does this to us. He dogs us. He deceives us. He distracts us. He discourages us, and he seeks to destroy us. 5 D's of Satan. He dogs us, deceives us, distracts us, discourages us. He seeks to destroy us. But Jesus Christ says to us in those times, be of good cheer, because I have overcome the world. And when we tap into that whole armor of God of Ephesians chapter 6, we're to be able to have our guard up against Satan's ploys, his fiery darts, and his strategies. Well, Satan failed, again, to cause Jesus Christ to sin even one time. He now stands judged. His days are numbered. Even though he has limited power and authority on this earth, his earthly rulership will be taken away. It's already been decided. He and the demons have a place to be thrown in the lake of fire at the end of the book of Revelation. It's very clear. The death on the stake or the cross was arguably Satan's greatest error once he gained dominion of this earth. His greatest error, even though his whole strategy was to try to destroy Jesus Christ, and events led up to that, but his greatest error was seeing that Jesus Christ never sinned once when he went to his crucifixion, and now Satan stands defeated. He participated in his own undoing. It's not a sermon about Satan, but it's interesting to see the strategies he used and how it backfired on him. Jesus Christ says, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. Back to Isaiah 53, verse 5. Isaiah 53, verse 5, but he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes or his wounds, we are healed. These references are found in the New Testament. Matthew 8 and verse 14, just very briefly, Matthew 8 and verse 14, if you'd like to join me there. This quotes this reference in Jesus Christ's ministry. Matthew 8, verse 14, now when Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw Peter's wife's mother laying sick with a fever. So he touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she arose and served them. When evening had come, the Sabbath had ended, it says in the narrative, they brought to him many others who were demon-possessed. They came and crowded the doorsteps in times like this. And you could see the people after the Sabbath was over bringing their sick and their lame on beds or with their crutches. And they would bring these people that were demon-possessed. And it says, he cast out the spirits with a word. He healed all those who were sick. that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, right here, what we just read, he himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses. We continue, we'll hold our place in Matthew, continue in Isaiah 53, verse 6. Isaiah 53, verse 6. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of us all. I won't turn, but Peter 2, verse 20 quotes this verse. 1 Peter 2, verse 20, for to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps. Verse 22, quoting Isaiah, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. There's a whole sermon right there, just on that passage. He was tempered, patient, long-suffering. He did not come to judge the earth, but to offer mercy and salvation. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. He suffered, but did not threaten in return. He allowed God to handle this, all those issues. He said, God, I commit these things into your hands. God is the equalizer, and God is the one who will come to our aid. It is said in Proverbs 29, verse 26, many people seek the audience of a ruler, especially in times when you want justice and you want to go to somebody who has authority to correct a bad situation. But the second half of that verse, many people seek the audience of a ruler, but it is God who gives justice to a person. God is the one that we wait on when we cannot correct things in this life, that God can. Back to Isaiah 53, verse 7. Isaiah 53, verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, he opened not his mouth. I won't turn, but we remember the situation where Jesus stood before the governor Pilate on the day that he was going to be crucified. The governor asked, "So are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said back to him, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he answered nothing to his accusers. Verse 13, and Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" Pilate was certainly in between a rock and a hard place. He had this situation where the custom was to let any prisoner go once a year to appease the Jews in Jerusalem. And of course, they let Barabbas go. He was a rabble rouser. He was a murderer. He was involved in sedition, in trying to overthrow the government. And yet they cried out the louder, "Crucify this man, let Barabbas go." A murderer, for in exchange for the most innocent person that has ever lived on earth. And so Pilate is struggling with this. Verse 14, but he answered him not one word, so that the governor marveled greatly. Why the silence? Didn't Jesus Christ answer openly in the public places for 3.5 years, in and around the temple courts, and in every road and every public place? And weren't all his healings done publicly? He didn't have to answer for himself. The testimony was already there. It was so loud and clear. Tragically, Governor Pilate was very weak in his resolve and his character, and he turned him over to be crucified to the Jews. But he could have stopped that event. He had all power in Judea to stop that from happening. Let's continue. Isaiah 53, verse 8. Isaiah 53, verse 8. Let me read this passage from the NIV, New International Version. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. We know that he was given an unfair trial, an illegal trial. And who can speak of his descendants. Somewhat cloaked language. It means he didn't leave any descendants behind him. It was thought of as a curse from God if a person in his family didn't have children to pass on the family name. It was thought of a curse from God at the time, or a tragedy. It says, "For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death. Though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit found in his mouth." Verse 10, "Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord Eternal makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring." Now, I mentioned he had no physical offspring, but you and I are the offspring of God. And in that sense, we're the offspring of Jesus Christ. He will see those who overcome and are given a crown of glory and who are transformed in a twinkling of an eye, either at raised up on the last day or at the time when Jesus Christ returns. If those left alive, it's going to be wonderful. And you and I will be, and that plan and the destiny is to be in the family of God for eternity. And so it says, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. And so, verse 11, "He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." On to verse 12. Verse 12, Isaiah 53, verse 12, "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great. He shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he has poured out his soul unto death. He was numbered with the transgressors. He bore the sin of many. He made intercession for the transgressors." We know that these are the things, the kinds of things that the two disciples on their 7-mile walk from Jerusalem to Emmaus would have heard. If not these specific passages, it would have been anywhere from Moses on forward through the prophets. In a moment, we're going to come back and conclude that story of the two disciples. A question might come up. Why did Jesus Christ maintain his disguise while he's walking alongside of these two disciples? Why does he not reveal who he is while he's expounding on these scriptures concerning himself? It has to do with focus. It has to do with keeping a vision and staying in focus and not being distracted by his persona. If he revealed himself as the Son of God at that very moment he's walking and talking with them, do you think they would have still listened carefully to all of the scriptures he was explaining to them? Maybe, maybe not, maybe not. Let me talk to you about a little illustration about keeping a goal in focus just for a moment. It was back in April 10, 1970, when the third manned lunar landing was launched from Cape Kennedy in Florida. There was a 3-man crew that went on a 3-day journey to the moon, about 250,000 miles away from Earth. And suddenly, one of the Apollo 13's command module oxygen tanks exploded. This is very much dramatized in that great movie, Apollo 13, where Tom Hanks starred in that movie. It was a 1995 movie. You get to see, you know, pretty much what actually happened in that command module. So this oxygen tank explodes after a routine liquid oxygen mixing procedure. And then up until then, the mission had been pretty routine. Everything was going as normal. But now an audience of perhaps 2 billion people on Earth are watching on the news reports, reading the newspaper, the latest headlines about this suspenseful event out in deep space. And it's a very grave situation. Millions are looking upward up towards the sky, and some are praying verbally and some are praying silently for the safety of this 3-man crew at that time. And while they aborted the plan to land on the moon, they had to come up with a strategy to get these astronauts back home. They still needed to swing all the way around the dark side of the moon like a slingshot to swing around it and gain the momentum to make their journey back to Earth. But they had to turn off the main navigational computer and the control computer that controlled so many things. And they had to start doing things manually. If you remember in the movie, they lost the heat, they lost navigational control, they lost a lot of the functions, down to the bare minimum life support for this module to get them back home. Well, it was the very effective planning and training and the correspondence back and forth between engineers on Earth and up in the command module that helped them through this emergency. The flight director at Cape Canaveral, Gene Kranz, would declare that failure is not an option. His famous words, failure is not an option. We've got to get those men home. And so Captain James Lovell, played by Tom Hanks in the movie and depicted in the story, he won numerous awards for Best Picture after that movie came out, but it was a six-day journey to get back home. The crew needed to make atmospheric corrections once they launched their booster rockets to aim toward Earth. But there were huge risks. If they came at the Earth's atmosphere on a shallow angle, they would have actually skipped off the atmosphere going at the speeds that they do. The atmosphere is kind of like hitting a body of water when you're going that fast. It would have bounced them off into deep space, never to be seen again. If they came too steep, they would have gone careening into the Earth without enough to be able to slow them down to launch their parachutes to land in the water. So there's these fragile things they're having to do. How are they going to steer without an onboard navigational computer? Well, Captain Jim Lovell would find a set of three fixed points out his tiny window. He saw the Earth, and he picked two stars as a three-way navigational triangle. And he launches his retro rockets, and for 39 seconds, he's holding on to his manual joystick, that's what they call it, and so he's aiming at Earth. 39 seconds. He cannot veer off even more than maybe a couple degrees from these three points of reference. And during that 39 critical seconds, what did he have to do? He had to stay focused on the goal. The focus was so important for him. Now, I mentioned that short 39-second suspense to get them safely back to Earth, in which it happened. They came back safely. Life for us is not a 39-second event. Life goes on. It's a long path, a long road. But Jesus Christ maintained his disguise with those two disciples until he had interpreted enough scriptures about himself so they would capture a vision and stay focused. It was about strengthening their faith without being distracted by his bodily presence. They had to stay focused on the word of truth, on what he was explaining from the scriptures. Let's conclude our 7-mile walk to Emmaus. One more time, please join me in Luke 24 and verse 28. Luke 24 and verse 28. It says, then they drew near to the village where they were going, and he indicated that he would have gone further. But Jesus Christ shows that he would have just kept on walking and said goodbye. They would have gone into their home, and that would have been it. But see, at the end of the day, evening is drawing near. The disciples reached the house, but a stranger made no indication he's going to stop. Verse 29, but they constrained him. Abide with us. It's toward the evening. The day is far spent. It's getting dark out. Come on inside. Come and stay the night. And he went in and stayed with them. Verse 30. Now it came to pass, he sat at the table with them, that he took bread, he blessed it and broke it and gave it to them. He said a prayer over the bread that must have sounded so familiar in a vocal inflection in the manner that he would break bread. And their eyes were suddenly opened, and they knew him. And poof, he vanished from their sight. That's all the excitement they needed. Jesus Christ gave them just enough of a glimpse of him, but the vision was planted. The focus was planted for them, and let's see what they did next. Verse 32, they said to one another, "Did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us on the road?" Weren't we listening so intently to the revelation of him in the Old Testament scriptures? He opened the scriptures to their minds. He knew that they would be so overjoyed to see him again, risen from the dead, that they might have been satisfied without taking the precious time to reflect on the words of truth that they were hungering for answers for. It was all for a good thing that Jesus Christ cloaked his identity in their eyes, blinded their eyes. I think it's a very important lesson for us. If Jesus Christ were visibly sitting in this room today, well, obviously all eyes would be on him. I would invite him up on stage. I'd say, please come up and talk. We'll all be able to answer questions if he allowed us. I mean, it's all a fictional, but if he were here today, it would be hard to keep our focus, I think. I think it would be. We would certainly want to ask him a lot of questions on mysteries that have puzzled scholars for centuries. But the presence of Jesus Christ and the Father are in this room. And they're dwelling in those of us who have God's Holy Spirit in us. Jesus Christ is here among us where two or more are gathered in his name, we're told in the scriptures. His presence dwells in a powerful, living way in our midst, in our Bibles, in this living word, in ourselves. This very book that we're holding in our hands, this living word, Jesus Christ, in a sense, dwells in these words. And for these two disciples walking on the road to Emmaus, Jesus Christ wanted to burn into their minds these truths so that they might impart them to others who should in turn spread this precious knowledge to many thousands of others in their generation. Is actually exactly what happened, and it's exactly what Jesus Christ had in mind. What do they do next? Verse 33, end of the story. Verse 33, so they rose up that very hour. This was, remember, they only saw a glimpse of Jesus Christ when God opened their eyes to discern who he really was as he sat to eat with them. I don't even think, it doesn't even say that he took a bite of food at that moment. Boom, he vanishes from their sight. But they know who he was. Another 7-mile hike in the dark now, probably with torches. But they're so elated. They're so excited. They have a certain spring in their step. It's still somewhat rocky and mountainous on this road, but they make their way back to Jerusalem. They find the other 11 and those who are with them gathered together. Verse 34, saying, "The Lord is risen indeed and has appeared to Simon Peter." And they, the two disciples, told about the things that had just happened on the road, and how he was known or revealed to them in the breaking of bread. My conclusion today, Jesus Christ would say to you and me, failure is not an option. Failure is not an option. We have been gifted with a calling, a first fruit, a tiny remnant of people in a vast sea of humanity. 6.5 billion. How many people have lived and died since Adam and Eve? You know, there's many different conjectures. 100 billion, 150 billion. We don't know, but someday we will. Someday, because every person who's ever lived and died will be in a resurrection. So we don't know, but there's tremendous potential for vast billions. For you and me, this is our age of judgment. This is a time for judgment on the church. Failure is not an option. Matthew 7, verse 13. Just two more passages, and then we'll finish. Well, hold our place, please, in Luke 24. We have to see the very end. We're not quite there yet. Hold our place in Luke 24, Matthew 7, verse 13, for a moment. Here Jesus Christ warns you and me. Because we have been given this understanding. Our eyes and ears have been opened to the truth that once we put our hand to the plow, there is no looking back and turning back. Matthew 7:13, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, broad is the way which leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. Jesus Christ wants to make sure the truth is going to take firm root, deep root in his people. And when that is accomplished, and it was in the time that he spoke to these two disciples on the road to Emmaus, then he revealed himself to them, and then their joy would be complete. But he first wanted them to think about this word of truth and to really absorb it, what he was telling them. We know that we face many trials in this life. And as Jesus Christ said, from the days of John the Baptist till now, the kingdom of heaven has been forcefully advancing, and forceful men lay hold of it. That's the NIV version of Matthew 11, verse 12. I won't turn there, but that shows that there are challenges we face. But Jesus Christ also said, Matthew 5, verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Let's do finally finish the story. Luke 24, verse 36. Luke 24, Luke 24, verse 36, we know that as Jesus Christ suddenly revealed himself to the two disciples, they probably dropped their bread, they grabbed their outer cloaks, they lit their torches. I'm expanding on this a tiny bit. They ran probably as fast as they could those 7 miles back to Jerusalem with this exciting news. Verse 36, now when they had said these things, Jesus stood in their midst, in the group in this other room in Jerusalem now, and said to them, peace be with you. But they were terrified and frightened and supposed that they had seen a spirit. Well, actually they did, but not the kind of spirit that they were worried about. This was a spirit being that could manifest himself as flesh anytime he wanted to now. Verse 38, and he said to them, why are you troubled? Why do your doubts arise in your hearts? Behold, look at my hands and my feet, that it is myself. Look at the holes in my hands and my feet, and look at this spear hole in my side. Handle me, feel these hands and my feet. For a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. When he said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. Verse 41, but they still did not believe for joy. It was almost too incredible to believe. They marveled, and he said to them, to calm their nerves. And what a way to do this, to settle the anxiety suddenly. Have you got anything to eat? Now, it doesn't prove that he was hungry. It just proves that he was trying to do something that they would distract from the fear and the anxiety of him just suddenly appearing in this little room with all of them. Do you have anything to eat? They gave him a piece of broiled fish and some honeycomb. He took and ate it in their presence. And by then, they're probably sighing and laughing and hugging and everything else that might go with just a normal encounter with him at that time. Verse 44, then he said to them, these are the words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things must be fulfilled which are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. And he opened their understanding that they might comprehend the scriptures. And when these disciples had left Jerusalem to return to their home in Emmaus, they probably intended to take up their old employment again, to get on with their lives. But now their joy exceeded any former disappointment they had when Jesus Christ was crucified. God had a mission for them. Remember now how Cleopas and the other disciples said to each other, "Did our hearts not burn within us while he talked to us by the way and while he opened to us the scriptures?" And as we anticipate the exciting messages tomorrow on Pentecost, we'll take this journey even further to have the scriptures continue to open up to us the wonderful things God has in store for those who overcome, those who hold fast to what they've been given, those who cherish their calling with fear and trembling, and who advance forcefully forward.